Okay, the Sedra starts out, Kiseitse le milchom aloidecha. The Arizal says that there's a hint here to how a person fights the Yetzer Hara. Now, we're not going to go into the details of how that works, but there's a problem with that. And that is that it would seem that if you want to give an example of the war with the Yetzer Hara, it should be a mitzvah war, milchemes mitzvah, not a milchemes reshus, not a war that is voluntary. And this war specifically is talking about a voluntary war, because in a milchemes mitzvah where you have to fight and you have to destroy the seven nations, you can't take captives. So this parish is talking about taking a captive woman. It has to be talking, Rashi says, but milchemes reshus, a voluntary war. The war against the Yetzer Hara is not voluntary, it's mandatory. So how is there even a hint to the war with the Yetzer Hara from this parasha? That's a question. There is a Kliyoker way back in Sefer Bereishis and Parshas Bereishis on the Pasuk LePesach Chatas Rovetz, that the Yetzer Hara crouches by the Pesach, by the opening. And he says like this. He says that the Yetzer Hara is compared to a fly. If you have an apple and it is whole, the fly can't do anything with it. But if you take a bite out of the apple, then the fly can devour it. A fly can't start something. It needs somebody else to start. So he says the same thing with the Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is like a fly. If you don't give him a place to start, then he has no control over you. But once you make a pirza, you have a breakdown in your guard, then the Yetzer Hara has you. Therefore, you can't begin to fight the Yetzer Hara where it's things that are mandatory. Right? Because if you already let your guard down, you've lost for all practical purposes. You have to fight the Yetzer Hara on the permissible things and make a fence around the Torah, right? You have to be able to control your appetite before it comes to, should I eat the thing that's not kosher? But how can I control my appetite on the things that are kosher? Because if you can control your appetite on the things that are kosher, then you're not going to come, you haven't yet let your guard down, and the Yetzer Hara has no control. But if you're going to wait for the, to make the fight on the things that are prohibited, then you've lost the war. Therefore, the analogy to the fight with the Yetzer Hara is specifically in a voluntary war and not a mandatory war. Because if you don't start fighting the Yetzer Hara where it's voluntary, then you're not going to be able to fight him when it's mandatory either, because you're already on the defensive, not on the offensive. Okay, that's my understanding of that. Okay, next. In this Sedra, there's another hint to the month of Elul, which the Zohar Chodesh mentions. It says you have this woman who you capture, and you bring her home. So if she decides on her own that she wants to convert to Judaism, right, and she wants to do it L'Shem Shamayim, then there's nothing to talk about. She can go through a regular conversion process, and you don't have to wait any amount of time, and you can marry her. But if she doesn't want, so then you put her through this whole process. And in the end, you're hoping that she will give in and want to convert. So what do you do? And also, at the same time, we're hoping that the guy is going to lose interest in her. So you do everything to at least take away the attraction. So you bring her in your house and you make her change into a regular everyday dress, not the enticing dresses they used to wear during the wars. And you make her grow her hair. You shave her head and you cut her fingernails and you let her sit in your house for 30 days and cry for her mother and father. And the Gemara says not only her physical mother and father, she cries for her Avodah Zorah, for her old religion. And after that, if she decides at that point that she's willing, to convert, then you convert her and you can marry her. And if she decides that she's still not interested, then you make her keep the seven mitzvahs of Noach, and you send her away, and that's it, finished. So it says that the crying for 30 days for her mother and father, that's the month of Elul. Meaning there is a hint to the month of Elul and what it's all about in the fact that you let this woman cry for 30 days for her mother and her father. Now, what's the connection? So I have quite a few different ideas. But one that I think is reasonable is the following. The Shari Tshuva brings a contradiction. In some places it seems that the order of tshuva is, everybody agrees that tshuva starts with recognizing that you sinned. Without that, there's no tshuva. What's the next step? You recognize that you sinned. So in some places it seems to say the next step is you regret sinning. Because if you don't regret it, you're not going to do tshuva either. So first you recognize you sinned, and then you regret it. Now that you've recognized the sin and you regretted it, you stop doing the sin. Then you confess it, and you commit yourself not to do it again. That's the order of tshuva in some sources. Yet there are other sources that seem to say the order is different. The order is the following. You recognize the sin. Then you stop doing it. Then you regret doing it. Then you commit yourself not to do it again. Then you confess and commit yourself not to do it again. What's the difference between the two? When does the regret kick in? Does the regret come first and then you stop doing the sin? Or you stop doing the sin and then you regret it? Says the Shari Tshuva, there's no contradiction. It's talking about two different kinds of sins. A person who committed a sin out of character, a quirk, okay? A person is not usually a ganav. He walked into a store, didn't have his wallet. He saw something he wanted, and on the spur of the moment, he put it in his pocket, shoplifted. It's something he never does, right? It's a quirk. It's not his normal kind of thing. He doesn't usually go out shoplifting every day.
And he's going to get caught.
Right, and he's scared. Whether he gets caught or not is irrelevant, right? But he knows that God saw him, okay? And that kind of sin, usually when you recognize that you've sinned, you regret it. The regret comes immediately. And then you stop doing it. You return it, whatever, because you regret it. How about, though, a sin that a person is in the habit of doing? Does it every day. Speaks Lashon Hara. Every day he gets on the phone, talks to his friend, and they go over the whole neighborhood, nothing terrible, but Lashon Hara. Okay? So that person, if he waits to regret the sin, and if he recognizes he sinned, but he can't regret it, he enjoys it. He rather likes that hour of gossip. So if he waits to regret it, he's never going to stop. That kind of person has to stop first, and then as he gets out of the habit, he can regret it. It's like a smoker. A person who smokes, a chain smoker, doesn't regret smoking. He likes it or whatever. He may recognize that it's harmful to him, but he can't regret. He likes it. He has to stop doing it. And then, as he gets farther and farther away from smoking, he can look back and regret ever doing it. The regret won't come before he stops. That's what the Shari Tshuva says. So the only problem is, if a person doesn't regret doing the sin, what's going to make him stop? I understand if somebody recognizes these sins and he regrets it, he'll stop doing it. But if a person doesn't regret doing the sin, even if he recognizes that he's doing it, what's going to make him stop? So there are a few things that can make him stop. Let's go back to the smoker. Right? The doctor tells him, if you don't stop smoking, you're going to die in 6 months. Now that could be a very big incentive to stop smoking. Right? Because in 6 months he's going to stop one way or the other. So we might as well stop now and be able to continue living. So, a person knows that he has no choice, right? That he's going to have to stop whether he likes it or not. He doesn't regret doing the sin, he rather enjoys it. But he knows he has no choice. So that's going to make the person stop. Male over here, the same thing. We have this woman, okay? She really doesn't want to convert to Judaism. She would rather go back home, be with her parents and her old religion or whatever. But we give her 30 days to cry to realize that that's not an option. She doesn't know if her parents are still alive. She's in this strange country now with this guy who captured her, and it's not an option to go back. So she can either decide to close that portion, that chapter of her life, and begin a new life, or she can decide that not going to do that. We give her 30 days to cry. Crying creates closure, say the Rishonim. Give her a chance to cry for her Avodah Zarah and close the door on the past and be able to make a new start. If she can do that, then Adarabah, then she's ready to be converted or whatever. If she can't do that, then you can't convert her. She's still attached to the past. That's Elul. Elul is for sins that you recognize and you regret. You don't need Elul, you don't need Rosh Hashanah, you don't need Yom Kippur, you'll do tshuva. The sins that we need to do tshuva for yearly are sins that we get used to and that we don't necessarily regret because we enjoy doing them. But what is going to make us do tshuva and stop doing the sin? The fact that Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is coming. You're going to be judged. If you don't stop, who knows what's going to be with the coming year? So it gives you an incentive that even though you don't regret the sin at this point, you may regret it later after you stop doing it. But you're not going to regret it before you stop doing it. That's the month of Elul. A time for closure. It's the end of the year, right? Realize that you don't have too much of a choice to stop doing the things that you know that are wrong, even though you enjoy doing them, because the day of judgment's coming and you don't know what's going to be with your coming year otherwise. So that should give you the incentive to cry for 30 days and come to closure with the things of the past to begin a new year. That, I think, is one, at least, idea of this crying of the woman and Elul. Okay, next. Immediately next is the Bensoru Molad. Okay, you have a child who is just 13, just celebrated his bar mitzvah, for the next half year. It's a 6-month window. And he basically doesn't accept any authority, doesn't listen to his parents. He steals from his mother and father and goes and eats a certain amount of meat with the money that he stole, kosher meat, dafka, steals some wine, steals some money, buys some wine, right, and drinks that, a certain amount of wine. So he is a glutton and a drunkard, not a drunkard, but whatever. Right? So he, what's it called? This is Xolil Vesove. Okay, it's not a tremendous amount either. And if he does this during that 6-month window, okay, even though he didn't do anything else, just he's a kid who doesn't accept any authority, and he does these specific things in the exact same way that the Torah says that has to be done. His parents first bring him to Beis Din, and they give him malchus. They give him lashes. Then, within that 6-month window, he does it again. Same thing again. Then they bring him to Beis Din, and they have him executed. So Gemara said, just because this kid stole some money and ate some meat and drank some wine, we're executing a 13-year-old kid? What? He says, no, it's basically because the kid already at the beginning of his adult life shows that he has no concern for authority. He is a zolel v'sove, right? He's a glutton, and he's into drinking. And what's going to happen is that he's going to have to satisfy this habit, this lifestyle, and he's not going to have money. He's going to go out and steal. So it's a drug culture. And he's going to end up killing people and ending up losing his share in the world to come. And I bet he should die now and have a share in the world to come than die later and lose it. This is a sign. And the Gemara says, really, it never happened. And you need, all of the conditions that you need are almost impossible to be. The parents have to be of the same height, the same build, have the same voice. They can't be blind or missing an arm or whatever. They're 100% okay with all their physical faculties. It's almost impossible. So the Gemara says, it came to teach us, learn this parsha, and you learn something important about education, whatever it may be, some say about discipline, about education, right? And the Torah said it in such a way that's very impressive But it really can't happen l'maisa, but it's there to learn. It's a parasha to learn. So one of the Rishonim says, the Rashba, that from here we learn a tremendous thing about love of God. Here are parents that have a child that the Torah says is liable to a death penalty. But the parents have to bring him to get that death penalty. That means it's possible for a parent to bring their child and have them executed because God said that's what you have to do. That means the love of God can be greater to a person than the love of his own children. Okay? Which happened in history by the Akedah. That's why Avraham Avinu was chosen. Because he was able to love God more than he loved the greatest love of his life, Yitzchak Avinu, but that love took second place to the love of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That is what it's not going to happen. But the Torah wants us to know that that is a possibility. That love of the Ribbono Shel Olam has to be so great that it takes precedence over even love for a child. That if the Ribbono Shel Olam says, if this child does this, it's liable to a death penalty, then the parents have to be able to bring him to court and have him executed. It's a tremendous Nesoyah. It's not going to happen. But the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to know, theoretically, that's the level you have to be on. That was the Nesoyah of Avraham Avinu. By him, he actually did it. By us, at least, has to be something we learn about and know that it is theoretically a desirable level. That's all. The Ribbono Shel Olam is not going to put us to the test of making it happen because we're not Avraham Avinu. But on the other hand, we have to know that that is the desirable ideal. That's the ideal. Yeah.
And they said, like, just came up for a question about the owner of the family now to be paid his wife for a produce.
Yes.
And then the question comes, can you kill yourself? And then, of course, with Ruria, you know, the story about her hanging herself or something. Now, are you allowed to do this for yourself? Whether they kill yourself is not allowed. As you said, it would prevent a greater sin from happening.
Yeah, there's a difference of opinion. Some say that you're allowed to kill yourself if you're afraid that you'll be tortured. Some say you can't do that, but you can kill yourself if you're afraid that they'll force you to do a sin that you're liable to give your life for, and you won't be able to do it, to give your life, because you're going to, whatever, do it in a gruesome way, and you won't pass the test, therefore you're allowed to, if it's easier to commit suicide, you're allowed to commit suicide in such a case. Some hold you can't do that either. Right, you have to let yourself be killed, but you can't kill yourself. Right, Shaul HaMelech is Shiloh, whether what he did was right or wrong. What he did is because he was afraid that they would make a Chil Hashem and mutilate his body make a show of how they would mutilate the king of Israel, the Philistines. So some say that what he did was okay. Others hold what he did was not okay. It's a shayla. It's a machlokas. It says when it prohibits suicide, it says ach es dimchem lenafshot. Ach always excludes something. So some say it excludes these kinds of cases. Others say no, that it's not that case. In any case, it's a shayla whether you're allowed to do it or not. And if somebody does it, you don't consider them a halachic suicide. But if somebody comes to ask a shayla, you don't necessarily tell them it's okay. Okay. Okay, next. It says, the Gemara says, Mishnah says, a person who says, Al kansipur yagiu rachamecha, right, is mishaskin also. Chazan gets up, and he wants to compose his own tefillah, and he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, just like you have mercy on the birds, and you commanded us to send away the mother bird before taking her children or her eggs, have mercy on us. So you tell them to keep quiet. That is not a proper prayer. One of the reasons is Sha'ose mitzvosav or midosav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu rachamim ve'einu melech zeros. He is making God's mitzvahs into mercy, and who knows if that's the reason? It's a gzera. It's a decree. We don't know necessarily the reasons for mitzvahs. So you're saying, well, God had mercy on the birds, that's why he made this mitzvah, have mercy on us. How do you know it's for mercy?
It also says that it doesn't have mercy on the children, which is also...
Oh, we'll see. In other words, if God had such mercy, don't take the kids. Send away the mother and take her kids, right? Don't take her kids. Don't send away the mother. Leave her alone. No, it means that since God had mercy, right? It doesn't mean, right. In any case, that's what the Mishnah says. Then there's a Medrash in this week's Sedra. The Medrash says, just like God had mercy on animals, and he said you can't slaughter a mother and the child on the same day. He had mercy on the birds, and he said that you can't take the mother with the children. So too, God had mercy on human beings and said that the bris milah is on the eighth day, not later, not before. It's the ideal day, less pain or whatever. The Medrash says exactly what the rabbis say you're not allowed to say. They said it. So Rabbi Kivager asked this question. He doesn't have an answer there. Some say that it's only if you say it in prayer, publicly. But you could say it in learning or whatever. But what's the difference? I think the answer is very simple. And that's the following. That there's a difference between a reason and a taste. We don't speak about reasons in mitzvahs. We speak about taste, tami ha-mitzvah. What's the analogy? Eating. If somebody were to ask you, what is the reason you eat? It's not because it tastes good. That's not the reason for eating. Right? Because you can have artificial taste, put it on cardboard, and you can eat that and die of starvation within a few days with a good taste in your mouth. Okay? On the other hand, you can have something that doesn't taste good at all, and if you need to eat to survive, you have to eat that too. So the reason we eat is to survive. Because without eating, we'll die. Once we're eating, God made it taste good. Now, we eat to survive. Why do we eat the things that we eat? Why do we eat bread and not rocks? You can gain weight a lot faster if you eat rocks. Right? So why bread and not rocks? The answer is because bread is nutritious and rocks aren't. But that only describes what is there. But why? Why is bread nutritious? Why is it that people can integrate what's in bread and not what's in rocks? Right? There's no answer to that question. That's the way God made the world. God could have made the world where we eat rocks. Right? But he made it that what our bodies are made to do is to integrate the proteins, the carbohydrates or whatever in the bread and not the minerals that are in the rocks. But God could have made a world where you eat rocks. Why did he make it like this and like that? Nobody knows. That's God's will. Right? We don't understand why. We can understand, we can describe what, how it works. But why it's like that, there's no answer. Similar with mitzvahs. And once God said you have to eat, and what you have to eat, even though we don't understand the reason why, he also gave us an extra added perk called taste, color, aroma. Make it enjoyable to us. But that's not the reason why you eat. That's just an extra added perk. Same with mitzvahs. God said, look, just like your body has to exist and live and be nurtured, your soul also has to be nurtured. What soul nurtures the soul? Mitzvahs? Torah. Okay? So therefore, you have to put these little black boxes on your arm and your head every morning, because somehow that is the food for your soul. Why? Why little black boxes? Why not paisley boxes? Why not put them around your neck? Why not put them on your knee? Right? I don't know why. Just like I don't know why bread is what is nutritious and, right, I can tell you how the tefillin look and how they have to be. Why they're like that, nobody knows. But once God said you have to put these little black boxes on your head, right, or any other mitzvah that we have, right, eat matzah on pay. Why is that nutritious to my soul, right, and not something else? And why dafka that time of year? We don't know why. That's the same reason, the same idea of food. The reason is because that's the way God made the world. But once God gave us the mitzvah, he wants it to be palatable to us too. So he gave us ideas, tastes in the mitzvah too. I understand about Yetzias Mitzrayim, and I understand about all the ideas of tefillin and what it represents. But that's not the reason for doing it. That's just a taste. What's the difference? The difference is if the reason for something no longer applies, then the thing doesn't apply. But if the taste doesn't apply, then the thing still applies. Meaning, if the reason to eat bread, let's say the reason would be because, I don't know, because again, bread has carbohydrates, protein, or whatever. If all of those things would go away from the bread, then there'd be no reason to eat the bread. Because the reason is because it's nutritious, and these are the nutritional things. If those things don't exist anymore, then you don't eat the bread. But if the taste goes away, but it still has the protein, carbohydrates, whatever, then the reason still applies. Just the taste isn't there. The taste, it doesn't have an effect on whether you do it or not, whether it's effective or not. The taste is just an extra added thing. Memela, if the ideas behind mitzvahs are reasons, then if the reason doesn't apply, then the mitzvah doesn't apply. But if they're not reasons, they're just tastes, they're ideas, then just because the taste doesn't apply, doesn't, for instance, we'll say, Shabbos, God didn't want you to make fire on Shabbos because it's hard work. Okay, and God wants you to rest on Shabbos. Okay, so if that's a reason, then striking a match is not hard work. So I can strike a match, I can turn on a light bulb. Because the whole reason for this prohibition is hard labor, and this is not hard labor. It was hard labor when you had to rub two sticks together. Let's assume that that would be the case, okay? It's absurd anyway, but, okay. But if the idea, the Torah doesn't say that's a reason. The Torah says you can't do it. I decided that that is a good idea behind it. That's no more than a taste. It's not a reason. And therefore, even if the taste doesn't apply, the mitzvah still applies, because there may be a million other reasons that I'm not aware of why you can't make fire on Shabbos. Nothing to do with hard labor. That applies just as much to flicking a light switch as rubbing two stones together. So, if you look at the ideas behind mitzvahs as tastes, that's okay. If you look at them as reasons, then it's not. What's the difference? Is that the reason why God gave the mitzvah? Is that the cause of the mitzvah? Or is that just a perk for me? If I get up as a chazan and I say, look God, I know why you gave the mitzvah to send away the mother bird. Because you're merciful. And that caused you to make this mitzvah, then I'm attributing a cause, a reason to the mitzvah. That is 100% possible. Who said, who told you that that's the reason why God made this mitzvah? Maybe he had a million things that are beyond our comprehension. But if I say, look, I don't know why God gave us the mitzvah, but you can learn from this mercy, that's fine. That's one possible lesson you could learn from this thing. And if you look and learn that, fine. That's from my side. That's taste. That has nothing to do with cause. That's the difference. So the Medrash is talking about what I can learn from it. That's fine. To say that God gave it for that reason, that's possible. Okay? Brings us to other ideas. Right? First of all, if it's only mercy, then again, better don't take the birds, don't leave the mother alone with her children. Like, you have mercy. So, Elamai, are you going to say that God said, but man, these things were created to serve man? So at least do it in a merciful way. When you can't tell you can't take eggs and chicks, that's what they were created for. But do it in a merciful way, similar to the Gemara in Bava Metzia. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was walking and a little calf came and nuzzled against him as if to say, I'm on the way to the slaughter, have mercy on me. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi said to the calf, go, that's what you were created for. And because he didn't have any mercy on the calf, he was stricken with a toothache for 22 years.
What should he have done?
So the Chora, he was right. That's what animals were created, to serve man. They weren't created just to be around on their own. They were created to serve. But still, you can do it in a merciful way. Right? You can have a little mercy that it's a shame that you have to be killed in order to serve man. Be nicer if man could be served without killing animals. But if that's the way the world is, okay. But at least have some kind of mercy too. That's the idea. That's one idea. But there's many other ideas. To the extremely opposite, we'll see. Some say that this is, the Rambam in fact says, this is a mitzvah, that if you're looking for ecology in the Torah, here it is. If you take the mother with the children you could take because you want to, benefit from the world, right? Everything's like that, right? You cut a tomato, so you're taking from the world. The world is created to serve man. But if you take the mother and the children, then you are taking away the chance that anybody else could benefit from these things too. Leave the mother, she'll have other children. So don't deplete the resources of the world leave enough that it should be able to reproduce, and there should be resources for other people. It's mamash ecology. Right? Don't take everything out of the forest. Leave something that it should be able to regenerate, and there'll be a forest for other people too. Don't deplete the resources of the world. That's another reason, another idea behind it, another taste. Another idea is, you know why it's easy to catch the mother when you're taking the children? Because the motherly instinct is not to abandon her children. So the mother doesn't fly far away when she sees somebody tampering with the nest, because her motherly instinct is to save her children. So therefore, what are you doing? You're taking advantage of a motherly instinct to catch the mother. That's cruelty. Don't take advantage of her mercy to catch her. That's the mercy over here. Don't be cruel. Taking advantage of a mother's instinct to catch her is a cruel thing. That's another idea. And the next idea is the diametrically opposed to all of this. According to the Kabbalah, according to the Zohar, okay, everything that happens in the physical world has a spiritual counterpart. And whatever happens to the physical thing has an effect on the spiritual thing, and vice versa. There's no parallel worlds, physical world, spiritual world. What you do here affects there, what happens there affects here, and so on. Okay. There is a world up there, and don't ask me to explain it, not because it's a secret, because I don't know any more than you, so I'm not going to be able to explain any more than what I'm saying. There's a world up there called Kan Sipor, okay, a bird's nest. Now, down here it looks like a bird's nest. There it's a spiritual concept. In that world is where the Mashiach, right, where the seeds of Mashiach coming are going to emanate from that world, called the Kan Sipor. If you here chase away this mother and make her cry, it affects that world up there and creates a spiritual crying that arouses mercy in the heavens and brings Mashiach closer. So it's not that you want to have mercy on the bird. You want the bird to cry for her children, because that arouses the spiritual forces in heaven to cry for us and bring Mashiach closer. So you bedafka want to make the bird cry. It's not mercy for the bird. It's to make the bird cry so it'll arouse the crying in the heavens. It's a completely different idea. Okay, there could be a million other ideas that were the cause of this mitzvah, but we don't know what they are. We can have taste in it. That's the most we can have. Okay. One last thing. Okay, the Torah says, don't wear shatnez, but you can make tzitzis. Gedilim tasalach. The Medrash says, lo silba shatnez, gedilim tasa, bedibur echad nemru. Not only are they not contradictory, right? Because the Torah says don't wear woolen linen. Here it says you can put tzitzis of wool, because the tchelis has to be wool, on a beged of linen. So it's shatnez. So bedibur echad. Not only aren't they contradictory, but they were said at one time, meaning they go together. They're complementary. How could that be? Either you're allowed to wear shatnez or not. You could say it's an exception to the rule. But how could it be complementary? Right? It's maybe not contradictory because it's an exception. So the answer is no. One of the ideas behind shatnez again is a chok. Why can't wear shatnez? But we have an idea behind it. One of the ideas behind shatnez is the concept of, in the beginning of the world, Cain brought a sacrifice of linen. Hevel brought from wool, from his, and they fought over covet. So when it comes to covet, linen and wool couldn't get together. Clothing is covet. You wear clothing, it's your covet. Mechabdusi is called, clothing is called my honor. Right? People dress up, it's honorable, right? So in clothing, which is a person's personal honor, just like in the beginning of the world, wool and linen couldn't get together when it came to covet, and Cain ends up killing Hevel. So for all times, wool and linen can't get together for kavod. But that's in a garment that you wear for your honor. But if you're wearing the garment already as a sign that you are a slave of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the tzitzis, and that you're subjugated to him, and it's for his honor that you're wearing it, not for your honor, then the whole idea doesn't apply. Similarly, another place where shatnez is permitted is in the clothing of the Kohanim. Because they're not wearing it for their honor, they're wearing it for the honor of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So where the clothing isn't for personal honor, then the whole concept of shatnez doesn't apply. So not only is it not contradictory to be able to wear shatnez in tzitzis or in the big day kahuna, it's the same idea. The same reason why you can't wear it in your regular clothing is the same exact reason why you can wear it over here. They emanate from the same source.